the bright blue of the weaver's serpent eyes, but his white garland, his pack bond, was solid. Honey stood strong and resolute. Her right hand was held up and forward, extending the green and silver garland toward me. Her left arm was held a little behind her, and that hand held a few strands of tarnished tinsel that drifted limply in the light breeze that filled the cave. Each and every member of our pack was caught in a single frame of their lives. Some of them, like Mary Jo and George, were in their wolf form. Hoel was surprisingly his human self, and part of me knew that I'd been worried about him, but I couldn't remember why just then. All of those strands ended in my mate's right hand, and they reappeared in his left hand, which was extended to me. His head was turned toward me. The half of his body nearest to the pack was his own, strong and true. The half of his body nearest to me was the body of the monster. His head was his own human self, his expression caught mid-scream. The clear glass that was his shell was spider-webbed with fractures. The smoke filled the cave rapidly, first covering the floor and then rising to waist height. It curled around Adam like a cat at the cream.
"Ooh," it said, "pretty and broken."
At that moment, I realized that the smoke didn't belong to the weaver. It was familiar, though. Underhill. I had invited Stefan to my otherness, and he had come alone. But when I'd come here, filled with the power of the weaver's bite, power that was a gift from Underhill, the power had come with me, leaving the weaver behind. As I watched, she started to penetrate the fractures in my mate's altered body. I needed to stop that. But I was trapped where I was by the bonds that allowed me to keep my feet and resist that smoke. I strained helplessly, but I could not reach Adam. And that was when that niggling presence I'd felt, that presence that was not Pack, not Stefan, but bound to me anyway by thin spider silk that smelled of fey magic, that presence whispered in my ear, "Let me be. I can help you if you will only let me be." I chose not to answer it, because taking up that new bargain felt dangerous. Instead, I addressed the interloper. "Go home, Tilly. You are not welcome here," I said firmly. Tilly's voice was much louder than that other secret whisper. The sound echoed in the hollow cave when she asked,
"How can I be unwelcome when you brought me here yourself?"
"Not willingly or knowingly," I said firmly. "Go home."
"You can't make me go," she said.
And the smoke near Adam became nearly solid and formed Underhill's human avatar. Here, her hair was not dirty and her clothes were not tattered. She turned to Adam's form and bent to the ground, picking up a rock from the cavern floor. I held out my left hand, which was empty, as if I had known from the beginning that I would need it for something other than holding the ties to my beloveds. And I understood who and what that small secret voice was, and why what I was about to do was dangerous. Maybe I should have thought it over, but Underhill had a rock, and my mate was already a little broken. I said, "Come." And in my hand, a familiar weight settled. So light for the power it represented in this place, where love and hatred meant more than earthly forces like gravity or magic. I pointed Luch's walking stick toward the smoke assaulting Adam's battered form. Light traced through the runes on the old gray wood and lingered on the silver on the blunt ends of the walking stick.
"Find your way home,"
the walking stick told Underhill as lightning arced into the center of her chest. Its voice was still a whisper, but somehow it rang through the air as definite as and bigger somehow than the lightning that preceded it. Momentarily, almost as if altered by a stray breeze, Tilly's face softened, then formed a grimace of rage. But as I stepped forward, able at last to move, pointing the walking stick toward her as if I were an extra in a Harry Potter film with an unusually big wand, her body became smoke. Then the smoke retreated, first folding in upon itself, and then disappearing altogether. As the smoke vanished, the glass figures vanished too. The cave gave way to open air. Between one instant and the next, I stood in the dark heart of a small grove of oak trees. I could feel the ties, but I could not in this moment see them. I was alone, except for the walking stick, which was very pleased with itself.
Mercy,
Adam's voice recalled me to the real world. Breathing heavily, sweat pouring off me, and both hands empty, I looked down to see that the wounds on my shoulder no longer bled. I blinked a couple more times before I could orient myself. I stood once more on an asphalt driveway. Adam stood between me and the enraged, ugly little man who was screaming in a voice that must have had some magic in it to sound so sharp and wrong. I'm here, I said, because Adam's back was to me. Only afterward did I realize that had probably been the wrong thing to say. To the perception of anyone watching, I had never gone away. I'm fine. I'm still me. I flexed my fingers, still feeling the impression of the walking stick in my hand, but there was nothing there.
Stole it! She stole it! The weaver screamed.
For a moment, I thought that he was talking about the walking stick. Then I realized that he meant the power that had followed me to my other place and had not come back to him. I noticed that the smoke was entirely gone from the circle, although the circle, stretching over our heads like a giant snow globe made with darkened glass, was still in place. Ben, Luke, and Kelly were on their feet. Kelly held the chain to Ben's collar, but they were all staring at the little man and his very noisy rage. There was no more pillar of rock. Only a cluster of people on their knees beside a very still body. That was something I would have to worry about later. And the little man raged on.
Quiet,
my mate thundered, the power of an alpha werewolf in his voice. And it was evidently as effective on very angry little men as it was on a restless pack of wolves. The weaver stopped his tantrum, though his whole body shook with the effort. His skin, where it showed, several shades redder than his hair. I have completed the second part of our bargain, I said into the sudden silence.
You never said you would steal it, the weaver said in despair. It was mine, fair and square. I bargained for it. You can't take it.
Underhill is what she is, I told him. She isn't a personage, though it pleases her to pretend. Any magic, any power that is hers remains hers, even if she lent it to you. You pushed it all inside me. When all of it was in me and you held none of it, it became hers once more. It has returned back to where it came from. Adam, once he had determined that the weaver was no longer a physical threat to me, stepped aside. We faced each other, the weaver and I. I have completed the second part of our bargain, I said again. You came here in your own blood and bone. You bit me and failed once more to hold me. Now, as agreed, I will answer one question and then give you one truth. Ask me your question, Smokeweaver.
Why you? He asked. Why were you able to resist my power? And you, the second person I bit after my escape? How did chance favor me so ill?
In words, it was more than one question, but it felt like they were twined together. Something that would balance the truth I would have for him after I answered. For the first time, I really felt the power of a fey bargain. Because certain things became very clear to me that had not been clear until he asked his question. I didn't gain new knowledge, but all the bits and pieces seemed to gather together. I just had not realized until the weaver's question how much I actually knew. I was supposed to be the first person you bit, I told him. Underhill had driven me out of my own house, hadn't she? Just after the weaver escaped. She could not break her bargain with the weaver, but she could cheat. Your power came from Underhill, was a part of Underhill, I told him. And so it was limited by her limitations. Had you bitten me while I was standing in Underhill's own realm, I might be in your power now. But this is not the heart of Underhill's power. And where I had unwittingly taken her magic was the heart of mine.
Why you? Repeated the weaver.
Because I am Coyote's daughter, I told him, though that would mean nothing to him, trapped as he'd been in Underhill. So I explained in a way he could understand. My father is a primal power, and he has jurisdiction over certain spiritual magics. He is an agent of chaos. Underhill's magic, wielded secondhand, could not prevail over that. Not in my otherness.
I would have killed you if it had not been for the vampire, growled the weaver bitterly. You are not that powerful.
I nodded. Yes, not by myself. But my mate, my pack, and my friends and allies are part of my power. That the vampire saved me was because of my own earlier actions. He was something I had the right to call upon.
Accepted, said the weaver sadly. Your answer is full and whole truth. Give me then your truth that I have not asked for, would not ask for.
He knew, I thought. There is a more complete answer for your question than what I have given you, I told him. He was right. I didn't owe him more. But I felt that I needed to give it to him to keep the balance of our bargain. It was insight that I wouldn't have had without our bargain after all. Underhill released you on purpose. You did not escape against her will. She is girding up for war, and so collecting all the bits of herself that she had used to make better playthings. The Fae aren't playing nice, Tilly had told Aiden when she first put the door in our backyard. The weaver looked up at me. She had intended her bargain with you to be small. She told me so. She carefully found something that you wanted, to be able to appear human so you could more easily blend in with humanity.
To make better bargains, agreed the weaver. Bargains are more necessary to me than soup or bread. Better that I should starve than to have no one to bargain with.
She made a mistake. The power she gave you was no small thing. I thought of how I had perceived the smoke in my otherness, how immense and heavy it had felt. It had contained so much of Underhill that she had been able to manifest in the heart of my spirit. To the weaver, I said, she did not understand how much power she must give up to allow you to overcome another's will, to steal their spirit, and she feels that she needs that power now. She used me to cheat you of your due, but she did it without breaking your bargain. You lost the gift she gave you. She did not take it from you. That was behind the avarice she felt when she looked at Aiden as well. If the weaver had consumed a noticeable amount of her magic, how much more of her magic did Aiden hold? The weaver nodded slowly.
I understand. Now, your truth?
He looked small and powerless, an object of pity. I turned my head to watch Nani Palsik pull James up to a sitting position. Saw him turn his head, and heard his voice, soft and rough, say, Nani. I thought of Anna and Dennis, of Ben, who had had all the trauma he ever needed in his life well before the weaver had bitten him, of Stefan, helpless, bound and tortured, of a young hitchhiker, and Lincoln, a wolf I didn't know but whom James Palsik had mourned. Your name, I said, is Rumpelstiltskin. And then, because it felt like the right thing to do, I said it two more times, pronouncing it carefully each time. Rumpelstiltskin, Rumpelstiltskin. In the story, the little man danced about in a rage until the earth opened up beneath his feet and swallowed him, never to be heard from again. Today, the little weaver's rage was spent, but the earth still opened up and swallowed him, shaking under my feet and sending me staggering forward. If Adam's strong hand had not grabbed my wrist, I might have fallen in as well. That was twice he'd stopped me from falling to my doom, or at least to my harm. Adam was good at saving people other than himself. The earth closed again with a final crack, leaving only a thin break in the asphalt of the circular drive where the hole had been. A voice by my elbow said,
That was fun.
I looked down at Tilly without favor. I swallowed the first three things I wanted to say because none of them would have been smart. Duplicitous, sneaky, and horrible she might be, but she was unimaginably powerful and old, and we still had to hold to our bargain, another bargain, to make Aiden available to her. Adam was watching me, letting me take point on this one, because I had just demonstrated that I had a little more information than he did.
"I wish you hadn't given him the answer to his question quite as thoroughly as you did," she continued when I didn't say anything. "He's not going to be as fun a playmate as he usually is, at least not for a while. He knows how to hold a grudge."
"How is it that you are able to come here?" I asked, because it was worrisome. There was a limit to the distance she could travel from one of her doorways, or so I had been led to believe. "There is no door to your realm near this place."
"No," she agreed sadly. "But he drew this circle we stand in with power he got from me."
She frowned up at me.
"I did not intend for you to figure that out."
"I imagine not," I told her.
"Mercedes Thompson Hauptmann," she purred with one of her mercurial mood changes. "You are more interesting than I imagined."
And the circle broke. The sun brought light, a breeze blew away the last remnant of smoke, and Tilly disappeared with a crack that sounded like a great rock breaking in half. Ben said,
"Get this freaking collar off me, and get me a phone. We need to check on the house. He was in my head, you nitwits, and he had Harrowford like he had me. Harrowford and Fiona knew we left the house, left the children, the humans with only Hoel to protect them. They knew, and I couldn't get you to pay attention, to listen to me."
As if to make up for the freaking and nitwits, he devolved into a solid stream of swear words. I lost the gist of what he was saying because I was sprinting for Jesse's car where I'd left my cell phone. I had 12 missed calls. I called Lucia on the grounds that she would know what had happened and no one else here would try calling her first. She picked up on the second ring. "They came," she said, not waiting for me to say anything. "A woman and a man. They shot Hoel. He is fine. One thing the Tibesina spirit is good for is that it takes more than a bullet to hurt my Hoel. Libby grabbed one of the rifles from your gun safe and, from your upstairs window, she shot the man who had the gun. The female carried him back to their car, and they left." I sucked in a deep breath of relief and met Adam's gaze across the 20 yards of driveway. Because even as I'd run for my car, Adam had run for the SUV. He, too, had a phone against his ear. I gave him a thumbs up. He nodded, then went back to his call. James was going to survive. Adam offered them all a place in the pack if they wanted it. James shook his head.
"Not that I'm not grateful," he wheezed, "but I had a couple of hours that felt like a year to contemplate what you all go through living in Crazy Town. Bran invited us to Montana, said we could take some time up there to catch our breath, maybe find another good pack in a few months."
"Or years," said Nani. James nodded, pointing a finger in her direction. Kent got to his feet.
"Fee and Sven won't be best pleased with us. If we are going to go, I suggest we go now. We're packed. I'll get the car and Li Qiang and I will get it loaded."
"Careful," said James. "That's what I was doing and then poof, I was a rock."
I called Bran to tell him they were coming and watched Adam's face out of the corner of my eye. There was a white line on his cheek from the clenching of his teeth. I hung up. "He says someone will meet you in Spokane to escort you the rest of the way. That way you aren't trying to drive the dirt roads in the mountains of Montana in the middle of the night." I gave Bran's number to Nani. James's phone had not survived its time as part of a rock. And I gave her the number of the pack member they would meet in Spokane. We saw them off. They drove an Accord with a V6. I don't know what happened to the bug I'd repaired for James. Once they were gone, we dusted ourselves off and looked at our available rides home.
"My car is fine," Jesse said cheerfully. "Dad, you and Mercy have got to take better care of your stuff. Do you think that money grows on trees?"
Hoel took a few hours to downgrade from his Tibesina form to the Presa Canario. But the more mortal dog showed no signs of having been shot. A few hours later, without help from Aiden, Hoel was able to wear his human self for the rest of the night. Despite Adam's belief that Hoel's unexpectedly long stint as a human was a result of the time Hoel had spent in Tibisina form, any number of the pack offered to shoot him again, or get Libby, the sharpshooting heroine of the hour, to do it. I called Beauclair and told him most of what had happened to Rumpelstiltskin, and warned him that Underhill was amassing power for something.
"Yes," he said, "we have noticed."
I almost said thanks for the warning, but not thanking the Fae is a good general rule for people who want to live a healthy and free life. The same could probably be said for sarcasm. Instead, I said carefully, "The clues that you gave to me when we talked were instrumental in allowing me to identify Rumpelstiltskin."
"I am happy that I was of service," he said.
"May I ask one question?"
"Of course."
"Why did Rumpelstiltskin's magic not feel like Fae magic to me?"
"He is of an older lineage. Most of them were gone when I first came to the Earth, and that was a good long time ago. The reason he survives is probably because of the friendship he developed with Underhill."
"Friendship?" I said.
"Not all relationships look alike," he said.
"Indeed," I agreed. "Are we friends?" I probably should have waited until I'd had a good night's sleep before calling him, I thought. That was not a safe question. He laughed.
"Perhaps tentative allies. Definitions are not always useful, are they? Mercedes, thank you for dealing with the Smoke Weaver. We will open our gates at dawn and allow our people to go about their business."
He had thanked me. I wasn't sure what that meant. "Good," I said. I called Marsilia next, but she did not pick up the phone. 5 minutes later, she called Adam. He told her basically the same story I just conveyed to Beauclair, edited for the audience.
"Ah, that explains Stefan's sudden improvement," she told him. "We despaired of his survival the past few nights, but he held on."
I remembered how bad he had been when I'd seen him in my otherness. "Can we go see him?" She heard me.
"No, he wouldn't want you to see him this way. I will call you as soon as he is better, or should he worsen again."
And I had to be satisfied with that. Like Stefan, Ben didn't just step back into who he had been before the Weaver had taken him. Being in someone else's power was pretty much a reliving of his worst nightmare. He had 4 weeks of vacation time built up at work, and he took those and stayed with us. The goblins found Harrelford's body in a shallow grave near the river, dead from a silver bullet wound, presumably Libby's. I asked, but all of the witnesses were pretty sure that Fiona could not have known who it was that shot him. The goblins did not bring us the body. They texted photos to Adam's phone. When Adam asked what they'd done with it, Larry, the Goblin King, laughed and said finders keepers before he disconnected. Fiona was still a problem. We stayed on high alert and bunked up for the 3 days following the banishing of the Smoke Weaver. But when Charles called with news that Fiona had been sighted in Wichita, Adam told everyone to go back to normal.
"People can only stay alert for so long," he told me, "and she is only one werewolf."
"Charles is only one werewolf," I told him, and he laughed. Adam was doing better was the wrong word. More stable was probably closer to the answer. There had been no further appearances of the monster. And when the moon hunt came, Adam wore his wolf's form just as he usually did. But I had seen his wolf fading, and I worried. The pack was uneasy, though no violence broke out. Adam still would not open our bond, but he put back on some of the weight he had lost, and he did not seem to be getting worse, so I bided my time. I had a date circled on the calendar. And if matters did not change, I was going to have another conversation with Bran. A month went by. Jesse started school and began looking for an apartment. Aiden started school, too. We enrolled him in sixth grade, which was a compromise. He would look younger than most of his schoolmates, but not so much so as to be an outcast. Tutoring by Jesse and the pack had brought his math skills up to high school level, but his reading skills were below sixth grade level. The translation spell did not help him read or write in English. We had none of the paperwork for him, but Adam and I sat down with the school district superintendent and told him the whole story, a heavily edited version of the whole story. We didn't tell him about the fire, just that we'd found Aiden in Underhill where he'd been trapped for a very long time. We didn't tell him that Aiden could burn the school down if he wanted to. I figured that most kids in sixth grade could burn down a school if they wanted to anyway. They would just have to work a little harder at it than Aiden would. The superintendent agreed that the circumstances were unusual and gave us a paperwork path to follow that would let Aiden start school. We managed to get it done, thanks to Kyle, who knew family law and could make it dance to his tune, and Aiden made it to the first day. There were a few rough patches the first month of school, but Aiden finally settled in with a group of computer gamers. He still had those moments that reminded me that he was centuries older than he appeared, but mostly he looked happy. I didn't visit Stefan, but he called me twice and sounded nearly himself the second time. He said that the hope I'd given him was still helping him cope. I didn't know what to say to that. "I didn't want to lose you," I said finally. "Thank you," he'd said, and he disconnected shortly thereafter. The pack killed a pair of ghouls who had tried to settle in near Lourdes Medical Center in Pasco. Apparently, hospitals are a favorite hunting ground of ghouls. We helped Marsilia roust a couple of itinerant vampires who tried to set up shop in West Richland. Rennie started coming to Sunday breakfasts with Mary Jo and struck up an unlikely friendship with Ben, our candidate for wolf most likely to end up in jail. Anna's ghost waved at me whenever I drove past my old place. I didn't wave back. Life happened, and we forgot to worry about Fiona. Chapter 14. I couldn't sleep. A heavy arm wrapped around my shoulders.
"Feeling restless?"
The growl in Adam's voice made my toes curl. They knew what that roughness meant, and they liked it. So did I. "Yes," I answered, my own voice a purr.
"I can help with that,"
he promised. And boy, did he. His efforts were above and beyond to the point that when his phone rang in the middle of the night, I only woke up long enough to hear a bit of the conversation.
"False alarm, probably, sir. Cameras don't—"
There was no stress in Adam's employee's voice, and it didn't sound urgent, so I went back to sleep. I woke up when Adam patted my butt. I cracked my eye open suspiciously, and he laughed.
"Not waking you up for that again. Not that it wasn't fun. But we have some equipment problems. The alarms at the garage are going off again, though the cameras aren't showing anything."
The system at my garage had been developing quirks over the last couple of weeks. His IT people couldn't run it down closer than an intermittent glitch. Adam had finally ordered a whole new system, but it wouldn't be in for a couple of weeks.
"I'm going to check in on that, then drive out to work and give my people a surprise visit."
He did those to keep his people on their toes and to let them know that he wasn't asking them to do anything he wouldn't do, because on his surprise visits, he'd sometimes pick a random pair of guards and do their patrols with them. Sure enough, he continued,
"I'll be out most of the day. I have a couple of new people to torment."
I grunted at him.
"Why don't you sleep in this morning?" he said.
"How is it that you are this cheerful?" I asked him plaintively. "You didn't get any more sleep than I did."
"I am male," he said, and wiggled his eyebrows like the villain from a B-horror movie. "Sex is better than sleep."
"Go away," I moaned, rolling over to bury my face in my pillow. He laughed and started to do that. "But kiss me first." He rolled me back over and did that too. When my alarm went off an hour later, I was really tempted to sleep in. Then I remembered that it was Saturday, and I would be the only one at work. Jessie and her friends were going to a concert in Seattle. Adam had fretted about security, so Jessie had called Tad and invited him along as her muscle, which was all well and good, but it left me alone to mind the shop.
I could have asked Z to come in, but he had a project of some sort going on and told me not to bother him for a couple of weeks. My official hours didn't start until noon on Saturday, but I had some cars to finish up and a boatload of paperwork. After a recent IRS audit, I was religious about my paperwork. In the end, I owed them $452, which they had graciously rounded down from $452.34. But at one point, before I finally located a box of receipts where I'd used it to balance a transmission, they had claimed I owed them a little over $6,000, which meant my accountant, Lucia, pointed out, if I could have found the other missing box, the government would probably have owed me money. So off to work, I needed to go. I felt better after a shower and some painkiller to ease away the ache of repeated vigorous nighttime activity. I paused as I was brushing my teeth. I never used to have to resort to painkillers. Was I getting old? Or had Adam started to use sex to make up for the fact he was keeping our bond closed down? When I got to the garage, it was still early enough that the lights in the parking lot were on. I waved to the camera and imagined Carlos or Butch, or Adam, waving back. The office, when I let myself in, smelled overwhelmingly of gasoline. I grimaced. Fuel odors were par for the course when running a garage, and at least gasoline was volatile and would clear pretty quickly once I opened the bay doors. I'd parked a 62 Mercedes convertible in the garage last night for safekeeping, and I assumed that was where the fuel smell was coming from. It belonged to a local car collector, the prize of his collection, and it was in for its annual checkup. It wasn't surprising that it had developed a fuel line problem. Even the best auto engineers in the world didn't factor in better than a half century of use. It was a little odd that Adam hadn't called me about it when he'd been here earlier to check the security system, but he knew I was planning on coming in early, and he knew that he'd left me short of sleep. I was smiling as I tucked my purse in the safe and locked it. The safe was on the floor under the counter, and my back twinged as I stood up. I stretched, touched my toes, and the ache dissipated. The stiff muscles clinched it, though. I would start with finding the fuel line problem, and that would give me plenty of opportunity to work out any lingering stiffness before I started on paperwork. I turned on the stereo and found a soft rock station. I hummed along with Spirit in the Sky, a song nearly as old as the 62 Mercedes, as I opened the door to the bays. "Hello, Mercedes Thompson," Fiona said. "We have some business to conduct." She'd been waiting on the far side of the garage, where she had a clear shot at me, and she was standing in classic shooter position with, if I was not mistaken, Adam's carry gun in her hands. I took a moment to assess the situation. A gas can had been overturned near the door, leaving a puddle of gasoline, designed to keep me from scenting an intruder, to keep Adam from realizing that he wasn't alone, too. In the corner, where the real brains of the security system lurked, Adam lay unmoving on the ground. "He wasn't dead," I told my panicking soul. "I would know if he were dead." "If you cooperate," she said, "I will not kill either of you today." "There is a chair," she said. "Go sit down." A couple of weeks ago, I'd pulled one of the sturdy metal chairs from the office into the bays. I couldn't remember offhand just why. She had set it in front of the lift in Bay 1, and on the ground around it were cuffs and chains that looked very businesslike. I glanced again at Adam. He was breathing. "Don't worry, your mate is alive. He'll stay that way if you follow my directions." She wasn't lying. "What did you do to him?" I asked. "Ketamine and silver," she said. "A little trick I learned along the way." "Jerry Wallace has a lot to answer for," I said. Jerry had been the first to concoct a tranquilizer that would work on werewolves, but I felt a little better. The tranquilizer could be fatal if the silver concentration was too great, but Adam was an alpha werewolf. It would take a lot of the tranquilizer to kill him. "Sit in the chair, Mercy." If I did that, all of my options were gone. "The alarm glitches were you," I said, to engage her in conversation.
There is a reason that The Boy Who Cried Wolf is a classic, she answered. I have a way with electronics. She nodded toward the corner where Adam and the heart of the surveillance system lay. The video is currently playing a loop after it replayed a segment of Adam coming in and leaving from a few days ago. His people won't know that there is anything wrong until they don't see you come in at noon. But you needed more than just to game the security system, I said. This is not only you're taking advantage of an opportunity. You had to watch us, track our habits, without anyone in a pack of werewolves noticing. I put a little admiration in my voice. There is very little that arrogant people like more than an appreciative audience. At the moment, I didn't really care about reasons or methods. I was trying to buy time. I didn't know what I would do with it yet. That depended upon her and whatever opportunity she gave me. That was trickier, she acknowledged, and more boring. Your house is supposed to be the home of a werewolf pack, so why are you teaching some kid to read? If I had to listen to another hour of H is for Horace, I'd have to shoot someone. Do you know that you have a baby vampire who likes to watch your house? Yes, I told her. I thought she had watched us, but she'd done one better. She had bugged our house. Those lessons with Aiden took place in the kitchen, the heart of the home. But she hadn't managed to bug all of it, I didn't think. We didn't talk about Wolf a lot because we didn't want to worry the pack, but he made sure that he didn't go unnoticed. 2 days ago, I know that Adam and I had talked about Wolf in our bedroom. If she had overheard us or come face to face with him, she would never have referred to him as a baby vampire. After considering my words carefully, I said, "For the past few months, we have had the government trying to bug our house on a regular basis. Adam does a daily sweep for bugs. How did you manage?" I didn't mention the fact that there were werewolves in and out of the house at all hours. She could not have done it without magic, and I didn't remember her being able to use magic. Bran would have mentioned that when I talked to him. And magic worried me. I thought about how she had called me by my married name that afternoon at Kelly's house. She had known me by my maiden name. If she and her group of lost wolves were searching for a pack to take over, I was not important except as a weakness to exploit. But in retrospect, I realized she had looked at me like someone addressing a target. "Not all listening devices are electronic," she told me. "I know a witch who specializes in surveillance." Suddenly, I was a lot more concerned about why Fiona was still here than I had been a few seconds ago. I reevaluated our interactions with Fiona and her pack, adding in witches, and some patterns started to make sense. A wolf trying to take over a pack would not make an alliance with a fey creature, which was why none of the rest of her wolves had known about the smoke weaver. Witchcraft explained why the goblins hadn't found Fiona or her people. Bran had told me that Fiona was selling her services to the highest bidder, and the witches certainly had reason to want revenge, or worse. I had a bad feeling about why Adam and I weren't dead. Fiona smiled at me. Her expression would have been friendly if I hadn't been able to see her eyes. "Now that you have finished flattering me, go sit in that chair or I shoot Adam in the head. In that case, I'll have to kill you immediately too or risk getting caught by your pack. If you cooperate, I will not kill him. I know you can hear that I'm telling the truth. Now, you have 3 seconds. 1, I sat in the chair, but not because she had started counting. Adam was coming around. I felt the draw on the pack bonds as he started fighting off the effects of the trank. I pulled the chair sideways a little so that it gave me a better view of Adam. Hopefully she'd think that was the only reason I'd done it. But it meant that while she was dealing with me, her back would be mostly toward him. I wanted her attention on me, though I didn't think she'd ignore him entirely. If he moved, she'd react. But there was a good chance that she would trust the drug. That trank was nasty business. But Adam had encountered it before. "Funny," she said. "But I don't care which direction you face." I raised my eyebrows and turned the chair to face Adam directly. "Put on the ankle chains," she said. The ankle cuffs were nylon and looked to be standard issue. With them on, I could use my legs with the same grace as the average mermaid on land. I deliberately fumbled with them to give Adam more time. The power that he was pulling made me dizzy. That draw alone was going to alert the pack that something was wrong. Almost as soon as I thought that, Adam's phone rang. Fiona's time had just been limited. All I had to do was keep her occupied until someone figured out where we were. And now the wrist cuffs. She had used two old-fashioned metal handcuffs, attaching each one to opposite chair legs. The bracing on the chair legs ensured that the cuff wouldn't just slide off if I tipped the chair upside down. She knew I wasn't a werewolf. Nylon cuffs wouldn't hold a werewolf at all. The metal handcuffs would last longer and really tick off the werewolf who broke them because breaking them would hurt. She knew that I could change into a coyote. She had called me Bran's little coyote pet. But she didn't understand what I was, because otherwise she would know that the cuffs, any cuffs designed to hold a human, were worse than useless. Maybe she thought it would take me a while to change shapes, the way it took a werewolf time. As soon as I had the handcuffs on, she walked up to me. She bent down to tighten the cuffs on my ankles. Then, smiling, she pulled a collar out and wrapped it around my neck. It fit tightly enough that it was decidedly uncomfortable. I heard chain rattle as she attached that to the back of the chair. Unlike the cuffs, the collar would hold me, coyote or no, so maybe she hadn't underestimated me as much as I thought she had. "Coyote's daughter," Kent told me, she said. That explains a lot, like why Bran decided out of the goodness of his heart to let Bleeding Heart Brian adopt you. I wonder what Coyote did for Bran for the Maroc to make a deal like that. I was pretty sure that it was my mother who had pushed Bran into accepting responsibility for me. But Fiona didn't know my mother, so I could see why she would look for someone else. Bran wasn't known for his soft heart. "Kent?" I asked. "He's one of mine," she told me. "Witchbound to my service like Sven was." She gave me a thoughtful look that I'd seen on other people's faces before, so I had my abs tight when she punched me in the stomach. It hurt anyway, but she was a werewolf. If she had wanted to, she could have killed me with that blow. "Hardesty family paying you?" I asked when I could breathe. I didn't want it to be them, especially when Fiona seemed interested in keeping me alive. I had close-up knowledge of the kinds of things black witches did with living victims, and I didn't know of any witches blacker than the ones in the Hardesty family. Fiona smiled. "I understand you had a run-in with them recently. They are very unhappy with you. I might have been offered a reward should you die, and a bigger reward for a live capture. They don't know what you are, Mercy. I haven't told them yet. But they know that you were the key in the deaths of their people, and they think that you might have been the one responsible for destroying a treasure that had taken them generations to build. Zombies. Charles will hunt you down," I told her, and she flinched. She was afraid of Charles. She should have been afraid of Adam. He had quit drawing power from the pack. "The witches pay well enough that I can hide for generations if I need to, and they have promised protection, too." She gave me a sisterly smile. "But you and I know how far to trust the word of a black witch. I have some value for them, too. They like to play with werewolves. Too much to ever put myself in their power." If she had let them witchbond people to her, she was already in their power. I didn't exactly know what she meant by the term, but I knew witches. "Kent told you what happened with the smoke weaver?" I asked her. It didn't matter to me, but I needed to keep her attention on me. "Bastard, I trusted him." True enough to keep her from reading a lie, but the bite in my voice was fake. I didn't want her knowing that I was wasting time. Something rose silently from the place where Adam had been lying. Something too big. "Oh, my love, what did you do?" But I knew. He'd had to pull everything he could to wash the silver and ketamine out of his system. He would not have been able to pull more to increase the speed of his shift usefully.
not to mention that she would have noticed if he had tried to shift to his wolf form. It was not a subtle thing. An unarmed human form against a werewolf with his own gun? The odds were not optimal. He'd have taken them, but he had another option. I did not think it had taken him 10 seconds to change from human to monster.
Fucking Rumpelstiltskin, Fiona said. What is the world coming to when you have to make deals with a damned fae and he turns out to be Rumpelstiltskin?
Rumpelstiltskin was the last word Fiona ever said. A giant, nightmarish monster landed on her from 15 feet away and ate her neck in the same motion. The gun went off because she'd had her finger on the trigger. She was dead by then, but the gun had been pointed at me, and the bullet hit me in the arm. The monster that had been Adam dragged Fiona's body back into the corner with all the useless surveillance electronics and settled in to feed, growling defensively, as if I might try to take his prey away. I didn't need to see his eyes to know that Adam wasn't home. Adrenaline is the enemy of control for a werewolf, and Adam had had to build up adrenaline to fight the tranquilizer even with the pack's help. He changed without a moment to spare for gathering his thoughts, centering himself. If he had changed to his wolf, I would have been surprised if Adam had managed to hang on to control under the circumstances. But that would have been okay. I was the mate of Adam and his wolf. Neither of them would ever hurt me. I did not think I shared that link with the monster. I shifted to Coyote and lost the wrist and ankle cuffs, but my neck was pretty much the same size in either form. I shifted back and found that the monster was staring at me. The sound of the cuffs hitting the floor must have attracted his attention. He inhaled, nostrils flaring. I didn't know if he could smell my blood over the scent of gasoline. I met his eyes briefly, silver and bright like the moon, then quickly looked away and down. He didn't make any sound, but I felt him come over to me. His nose touched the top of my head and trailed to my neck. I raised my chin and tilted my head, giving him free access to the pulse that beat wildly there. I was breathing in shallow, open-mouthed pants because I was so scared. I could smell Adam on him, but I could not smell the wolf, just a sour musk that smelled like rage and hatred and witchcraft. It had grown stronger since I'd last met it. I had made a mistake in not calling Bran sooner. Something warm and wet hit the top of my shoulder. Drool. He bit my neck. If I hadn't been wearing that collar, I'd have been dead. I think there must have been silver in it because he yipped and then roared at me. I kept my eyes closed because I didn't want my last sight to be this creature born of witchcraft and self-hatred. But he retreated back to his meal. He was so precise in his movements, the chair hadn't even skidded on the floor. He'd bent the collar, and it restricted my breathing now. The arm that had been shot wouldn't obey me, but I raised my free arm and felt around the collar. I found the latch and the lock. With two good hands and a lockpick, I could have opened that thing up in a few seconds, if wishes were horses. I could feel the stirring in the pack bonds, the rise of alarm. They would come here soon, and they would be able to take this monster down if they worked together. If they didn't hesitate, because it was Adam. But some people would die. And I would be dead before they got here. Because though he was eating again, his face was toward me, his eyes focusing on my exposed abdomen. Blow up the bond, Bran had told me, and then refused to explain what he meant. And he'd given me that advice without a full explanation of the extent of the problem. It wasn't like I had a lot of options. I closed my eyes again, because I couldn't do this with the monster staring at me. Then I put myself in the place where I could see the bonds. The pack bonds exploded into sound, as if I'd stepped into a firehouse in the middle of an all-hands 3-alarm fire. I told them, "Not now, hush." And the otherness quieted. I stood ankle deep in a creek so cold it made my feet ache. The bond I shared with Stefan was still wrapped around one ankle, and I felt his attention on me even though it was daylight and he should be dead for the day.
I could have called him to me, I thought. Stefan would not hesitate when faced with the monster my mate had become. No, I told him, not now. The bond around my waist was grotesque and repulsive. The red skin cracked open in places and oozing green slime. I opened my mouth and pulled out a diamond the size of a baseball. It had been faceted into a princess cut and was clear and flawless and cold. I pressed my lips against it to warm it, and I told it the same thing I had told the wolf when I fed him the amethyst. I love you, I said. This was a place where words were powerful things, and feelings even more so. What I imbued that diamond with was more than the words I spoke. It was the huge ball of emotion that those words invoked in me. All the memories, the laughter, the joy. When I took my mouth away and looked at the gemstone again, it glowed with every color I could imagine. I cupped it in both of my hands and told it sternly, I am going to feed you into my mating bond, and you are going to blow it wide open for me. The pearl had been a soft thing. The diamond was a more suitable weapon. I used the pointed end, which was sharper than any reputable gem cutter would have left, to widen one of the damaged places in the mating bond. When I had a hole big enough, I shoved the gemstone inside. The slick green slime acted as lubricant, making my job easier. When the gemstone was entirely covered, I rubbed the poor bond apologetically as the green slime hardened, sealing the wound. Not your fault, I told it. We'll fix this. I waited for a long time, watching the bump that was the gemstone slide toward Adam's side of our bond. When it felt like the right time, I said, Now! And the world went white. I expected to wake up back in the garage, but that's not what happened. I woke up lying on a stone table in a small, what was the proper term for a building that had a floor and ceiling but no walls, just archways that held up the roof? It had the form of a temple, though there was no sense of worship here. The floor and archways and the stone table I occupied were hewn from a tawny sandstone the color of a lion's pelt. The whole building sparkled a little in the afternoon sun. I sat up. I was wearing something that looked very much like the toga I may or may not have worn to a toga party in my dorm when I was a freshman in college. It was the same color as the sandstone, right down to the sparkle. I found that my hands and arms were bedecked with jewels, and there were gemstones on the sandals I wore, too. I stood up and walked over to the edge of the building, and a beautifully carved waist-high barrier appeared in front of me, as if it had always been there. And I just hadn't noticed it. The air was sweet-smelling, and the temperature perfect. In the corner of the room, on a small table, was food and drink. Music began to play, something catchy from the big band era that Adam was still secretly fond of. This is ridiculous, Adam, I said, because I was in Adam's otherness, on the far side of our bond. I had no real way to be sure of it. I hadn't thought that anyone else even had this weird place they could go to. But my instincts had never steered me wrong, and in the otherness, instincts were strong enough to feel like a guide through the weirdness. I was in Adam's space, and even here he was trying to protect me. Below the hill I was on, I could hear mortar fire. I'd never been on a battlefield, not an official battlefield, but I'd seen the movies. I knew what mortar fire sounded like. I kicked off the shoes, hitched a hip on the barricade, and landed on the hill beyond. The big band music accompanied me as I walked for about a mile on a path that kept trying to take me back up to the top of the hill. Finally, I stood still, put my hands on my hips, and said, Adam, that's enough. Then I stepped off the path and began wading through the dense foliage. About 4 paces into the woods, the music quieted and a path formed under my bare feet. This path took me down into a valley filled with dead bodies. I picked my way through them. Some of them I knew: Paul, Mac, Peter. Others I'd seen pictures of. People from Adam's military past. People who had worked for him. There was a whole section of people in Vietnam-era U.S. military uniforms. Some of them were missing body parts, and some of those had the parts they were missing stacked at their feet. Another section was filled with people I was pretty sure were Vietnamese, though that was not an ethnicity I had much experience with. Some of these were in uniform, some of them were not. Every face was unique. I had absolutely no doubt that every body corresponded to a person that Adam had killed, or he felt responsible for their death in some way. Adam organized his guilt in neat rows. And then there was the field of children, maybe 20 in all. Some of these had faces, but some were featureless, as if there was a blanket of skin hiding who they were.
"That's because I didn't see all of their faces," Adam told me. "The Viet Cong used children. So did the South Vietnamese, for that matter. I don't keep the adults whose faces I never saw, but the children were different."
He pointed to one faceless body.
"That one was up in a tree, keeping us pinned down for 2 days. I shot him, but Christensen was the one who found the body and told me our sniper had been a kid. I never saw his body, but I should have gone to find him myself. I was the one who killed him."
He gazed out at the row after row of his dead and said,
"I owed it to that boy to look at what I had done, but I chose not to."
I reached out to hold Adam's hand, but he stepped away from me. When I turned to face him, I was back on the top of the hill, in the building without walls, but this time there was no sunlight. A rainstorm thundered all around, and I was not alone. Elizaveta Arkadyevna Vizhnevetskaya stood with one hand on the stone barrier, the other holding an apple from the plate on the little table. She, like me, was wearing a toga, but hers was burgundy. Most of the time that I had known her, she'd been an old woman. Here, as on the day she had died, she was young and beautiful.
"He doesn't keep me in his garden of failures," she told me. "I wonder why that is."
"Because he does not regret your death," I told her. But I knew as soon as I said it that it wasn't quite right.
"No," she said, "because you absolved him of my death."
"You think I am perfect," said Adam's voice behind me. "Beautiful, even. I need to be perfect for you."
"Or she won't love you," said Elizaveta.
And here, in the otherness, her voice had a power that tried to seep into my bones.
"She needs you to be her hero, Adam, as beautiful and perfect as your face. You don't want to hurt her with your darkness, do you, Adam? And you carry so much ugly darkness inside you, don't you?"
"Buddy," I said, turning my back to Elizaveta to face Adam, though leaving her behind me made my skin crawl, "if you think I believe that you are perfect, you've got another think coming." He stood on the other side of the room, and I noticed that the corner of the building was falling apart. The roof was not even sufficient to keep the rain off him, off the monster. He was bound, as I had been bound, to a metal chair, larger than the one in my garage, to accommodate his size. And the bindings weren't handcuffs and nylon leg cuffs. They were vines of thorns that smelled of black magic.
"Don't free me," Adam said urgently. "I will destroy you. I destroy everything I touch."
He looked away from me. In a low voice, he said,
"I didn't want you to see me like this."
Elizaveta walked behind him and bent down to whisper in his ear. I couldn't hear what she said, but Adam looked at me and spoke.
"You are so perfect, so strong, my mercy. I don't deserve you."
"Perfect?" I asked. I looked down at myself and realized that I was missing a few things. "Ahem," I said, addressing neither Adam nor Elizaveta, but the otherness that made this confrontation possible. "I survived the wounds that gave me my scars. I would like them back, please." It felt as though a finger touched my skin with sparkly pain that faded quickly, but left the marks of my life behind. When it was finished, and I deliberately chose not to hear the faint laughing cry that might have belonged to a coyote, I peeled off my toga and displayed my imperfect self to Adam. "I jump into things before I think about how it will affect other people," I told him. "I am prickly and overreact when you try to protect me because I don't want to trust anyone to have my back. I dislike your ex-wife and won't make an effort to get along with her anymore, no matter how much easier that would make everyone's life." I took a deep breath. "I hurt you because sometimes I need to walk out on my own," I frowned at him. "And I'm not going to change any of it, though it would make your life better."
"And you like to make me mad," Adam said in a whisper, "even though you know I'm dangerous when I'm mad."
I smiled at him and nodded. "Yes, that's your fault, though. I wouldn't do it if you weren't so sexy when you're mad. And I love the knowledge that no matter how angry you are, you would never hurt me." Elisaveta bent to whisper in his ear again, but I took the walking stick in my hand. I noticed that it had made itself into a spear, as it sometimes did when I needed a sharp weapon. I thrust it into her, forcing her away from Adam. The spear sank deep, and blood the color of her toga bubbled out of the wound. I shoved her into the balustrade. "You are dead," I told her. "Go away." She tried to say something, and a viper fell out from between her lips, followed by two asps, and then she faded away. The spear had no trouble killing the snakes. I liked snakes. If these hadn't come from Elisaveta, I'd have let them be. But I didn't want to leave anything of Elisaveta's free to roam about in Adam's otherness. I turned to Adam again, and the vines in the chair were gone, the smell of black magic replaced by pine with a hint of mint. But Adam still wore the monster's guise, wounds weeping where the thorns of Elisaveta's vines had dug in.
"I am ugly inside," he told me.
"Me too," I said, "and I'm not as pretty as you are on the outside either."
"I'm jealous and spiteful," he said. "I don't like it when men call you, when Bran calls you, or Beauclair."
I nodded. "I'm jealous too, and I think I outmatch you for spite. I hate that Christy was your wife and is Jesse's mother." I looked around, and then grabbed his horrible hand and dragged him to the balustrade, still stained with Elisaveta's blood. I climbed on top of it, and the blood disappeared before it could touch my dirty, bare feet. Balanced on top of the stone, with his big hand making sure I did not fall, I leaned over and kissed him. "I pick you," I said, and the world dissolved around me. I sat in the stream in my own otherness. The water was really, really cold. A big gray wolf, his feet and muzzle much darker than the silvery fur on his back, waded in beside me. He put his muzzle on my shoulder.
"I wanted to tell you that I love you too," he said.
I blinked up at the shop light that was suddenly over my head.
"Your arm is broken," said Adam, his voice ferocious. "I have it wrapped to stop the bleeding, but as soon as Carlos gets here, we're taking you to the hospital."
"Fiona was working for the witches," I said. His face filled my world, and I realized he was in his own human skin.
"I know that," he told me. "I heard."
"We need to tell Bran that Kent was witchbound, whatever that means."
"I will," he said. "Shut up now. Save your strength."
"I love you, even though you aren't perfect," I said. He met my eyes.
"I know that."
"I'm not perfect either," I told him.
"I know that too," he said, his voice growly.
"You need to find some clothes to wear. And I think I'm in shock." And I passed out before he could tell me that he knew that too. About a week later, I was sitting at the kitchen table, and Adam sat down beside me and kissed my shoulder, the one connected to my unbroken arm. "Hmm," I said, writing down the parts number from the catalog I was ordering from. The guy who ran this particular parts yard didn't believe in the internet, but he had parts that no one else carried. The order was made more difficult because I had to write everything down with my left hand. But mostly I kept writing because I could feel Adam's amusement traveling through our mating bond. He was about to do something or tell me something that he thought was really funny. "Okay," I said, looking up. His face was lit with laughter, and it looked good on him.
"First," he said, "I need to tell you that Izzy's mother is very sorry. She didn't realize that the client she was talking to is the sister of a reporter for a tabloid."
Izzy's mother sold essential oils. I couldn't imagine what she...
"Butch apologizes," Adam continued, "because when I told him to watch the newspapers and TV news, he did not consider tabloids until he caught one of our new guards reading one of them."
Adam set a stack of tabloid newspapers on the kitchen table in front of me. There must have been 10 or 12 of them. The front page headline of the one on top said, "Human, wife, says alpha werewolf is sex fiend, seeks help from friend." And that wasn't the worst one. I laughed until I cried. Then Adam picked me up, careful not to jostle my broken arm, and growled,
"Nudge."
"Help," I called as he carried me up the stairs. "My mate is a sex fiend. Help." There was no help for me. Adam got called into work that night, so I was alone when the sounds of a guitar and a violin drifted through my closed window. I got up and shoved the window open, which would have been easier without the stupid broken arm. Sitting cross-legged on the hood of my old rabbit parts car, Wolf played a violin. In front of him, standing on the ground but with one foot on the bumper, Stefan played a guitar. They managed a pretty good version of the sound of silence. Small hesitations here and there made me think they hadn't practiced it. When they were done, Wolf slid off the car and took a bow with a flourish worthy of a Shakespearean actor. But it was Stefan's grin, not Wolf's bow or the performance, that put a smile on my face as I closed the window. On the top of my chest of drawers, just as though it had always been there, the walking stick lay in its usual place. This is Lorelei King. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Smoke Bitten by Patricia Briggs. This program was produced by Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2020 by Hurog, Inc. Production copyright 2020, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.